This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an update from Kit Kittredge, just back from Gaza for the third time, went there with Code Pink.
She'll describe that trip as well as ongoing actions to try and break the blockade of Gaza.
The possession of drugs in Mexico and Argentina has been decriminalized.
Today we'll hear from Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance. He's been fighting for decriminalization for 20 years, and slowly, but now maybe more quickly, we're seeing some results of his campaigns.
We'll learn how the volunteer group Food Not Bombs has been infiltrated and surveilled by the government.
You'd think that our federal and state agents would leave people giving free food alone, but they don't, particularly when it's food and not bombs.
Stay with us.
Michael, down in Miami on October 13th, Antonio Guerrero, one of the Cuban Five, was resentenced. And I understand the government had reached an agreement with Guerrero's lawyer, Len Wineglass, that they would agree to tack on an additional 6 years to the 10 or so years he's already served, that the judge broke that agreement. What was your take on that?
Well, the agreement that Lenny Wineglass reached was Guerrero would get a 20-year sentence, which would mean, considering what he served already, he would have to serve another 9, but he gets good time, so it would have been another 6 years. And it would be very unusual for a judge with that high of sentence to go against what the prosecutor and what the attorney agreed to. But, of course, everything's unusual in Miami. And as if we discussed on this program before, that the idea that this case was ever tried in Miami makes a joke out of any idea of fairness, neutrality, etc. So here you go. Lenny goes down there with an agreement in hand. It says we guarantee him a 20-year sentence. He served whatever he'd served. He had 6 left if he had gotten that sentence. And already, of course, the Miami community was screaming for his scalp, saying sentence him to life again. And, of course, the Court of Appeals had reversed the life sentence because it had been sentenced on a crime even they found that he didn't commit. So the idea that he would get another life sentence after a lower crime had been charged is ridiculous, but, you know, Miami is ridiculous. So Lenny goes in there with this agreement for 20 years. And then what happens, Michael?
The judge, who's looking to get appointed to the Court of Appeals and who's a cold-hearted individual, said to the government, how can you come in here and agree to add only an additional few years to the sentence when years ago you told me that these people were a danger to the country and should be put away for life?
Well, the question is, who is that question favorable to? Was it favorable to the defendant, or was she saying to the government, I'm going to go above these guidelines because you guys told me this is one of the most dangerous people?
That's exactly what she was doing. So Len Wineglass said to her, you're sentencing a man, not a country. And he recounted to her the good works that Tony Guerrero has done in this maximum security prison in Florence, Colorado. Well, he's been teaching people how to survive when they get out, which is something the prison system should do. He's been teaching them English. He's been talking about job skills. He's one of the leaders in the prison. He really has a distinguished record in an American prison. And it was on that basis, because they couldn't re-argue the crime. They've been convicted of the crime, as ridiculous as it was, conspiracy to commit espionage sometime in the future.
With no espionage documents. He was working on a military base.
You know why? Because the Cubans, this is right after 9/11, and the Cubans thought the Bush administration may invade Cuba. And at that time, it was not a paranoid fantasy. It really was a possibility. We all thought that, too. And Guerrero's job was, if there was ever a marshaling of all these airplanes to take off in the direction of Cuba, he would alert the Cubans. Of course, you could see the same thing if you were eating breakfast at the diner across the street from the base. There were no military secrets here. There were no documents taken.
So in the end, the judge basically said, I'm not going to accept the 20-year agreement. I'm going to sentence him to 22 years, which in the context of this case and Miami, actually she didn't do as badly as she could have. I mean, it was bad. Believe me, this is terrible that she went outside the agreement with the prosecutor. But 22 years is not life in prison. And so in many ways, Could you call it a victory, Michael?
I think all proportions garnered, it is a victory, and I think it's a real salute to Len Wineglass for the brilliant lawyering that he did in getting that sentence reduced.
And now we're waiting on the resentencing of three other people.
Two others.
Two other people. Right. There's two others that are going to be resentenced. We don't know what they're going to get, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of possibly what Guerrero got. We don't know. The other two, one is doing a life sentence, and he's not being resentenced, and one is going to get out in a few years, I think, who's not being resentenced.
Here's the irony. What these people did was they spied on terrorists in Miami and reported what these terrorists in Miami were about to do to the FBI. The FBI took the documents that the Cubans gave them, and instead of acting on them to stop terrorism against the island of Cuba, they found out who the Cubans had placed in these terrorist organizations in Miami, and they arrested those people. It's a comment on the fraud of the American war against terror.
Over the last few weeks, we've been giving our listeners updates on the ins and outs or the meanderings around of the Goldstone Report. That's the report that Judge Goldstone wrote on war crimes in Gaza, condemning very heavily, in particular, Israel for many war crimes, including the deliberate targeting of civilians, finding the Palestinians had committed war crimes as well by launching rockets into civilian areas, but really, really much more really documenting for the reason that many more war crimes were committed by Israel. And of course, the United States position has been just awful on it. The Human Rights Council, when the report was presented, Michael Posner from Human Rights Watch called it fatally flawed. We talked about that. In this last week, the report was going before the Security Council. The Security Council is the one organization in the UN that can refer the report to the International Criminal Court for Criminal Investigations. And, of course, it's subject to a veto by any of the five permanent members of the Security Council, including the United States. So that report has been presented. Some 50 countries are going to speak with regard to what should happen to that report. And, of course, most of them, if not every one, will say, let's send this to the International Criminal Court. Think, what's wrong with that? International Criminal Court seems to be a relatively fair court. It'll look into both Hamas violations of war crimes as well as Israel. But I'm doing this before they've actually cast the veto, but there's not any question that this report and the referral, so-called referral, of Hamas and Israel to the International Criminal Court will not happen. What's an abomination about it is first that Obama is getting the Nobel Peace Prize when he didn't speak out a word against Gaza, and now the United States is about to veto any referral to the International Criminal Court. This is the man who gets the Peace Prize. Sad day in America. Today, in our continual reporting of the situation in Israel and Palestine, we'll be talking with Kit Kittredge, who recently returned from Gaza. Her report is really devastating. Living conditions in Gaza continue to deteriorate. Salt water has contaminated a large percentage of drinking water. Many who can afford it are trying to leave the region. To give us this update on living conditions, we'll catch up with Kit and Code Pink on her recent trip to Gaza. She will also bring us up to date on the march that's planned in Gaza, as well as the Goldstone Report and the reaction in Gaza.
Kit Kittredge, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Kit, you've been centrally active with Code Pink in building the Free Gaza movement. I know you're going on the demonstration between Christmas and New Year's to Gaza to break the siege. But before I ask you all the details of this, just tell me in a moment, how did you get active in this kind of political involvement?
Well, I think when George Bush was elected too many years ago, and unfortunately for such a long time, I'm a mother and a grandmother, and it turned my stomach to think that we were handing on a less better world to our children. And so I felt like I needed to really step into the more active role of a concerned citizen. And so I found Code Pink, and they are my style with the meaning and purpose and fun and creativity and intelligence and integrity to make a change.
So you went with Code Pink to Gaza back in June, and I understand you've recently gone there as well.
Yes, I went with the first delegation, which was over International Women's Day in March. Then I returned again end of May, June, and we were there taking in playgrounds for children, and that was our focus then. And then I did just return September 23rd or so this last time, yeah.
And how do you find the conditions there? Are they improving, deteriorating, or something else?
They're definitely deteriorating. It is a place under siege, as you know. I consider it a very deliberate, slow strangulation of Palestine. And because it is a slow strangulation, it doesn't make the news, as would an entire annihilation. But many, many different situations are occurring that are just deteriorating. The biggest thing is that they're more demoralized, depressed, and their diminished sense of hope. When I was there in March, people were like, oh, good, people are coming. They're finding out what's going on. And now people are saying, you know, what's the world knows, but nothing is happening. We feel forgotten, and we feel by those who do know that nothing is happening. So that was the most notable thing. But on a more concrete level, Hamas's presence is much more prevalent due to the internal pressures, you know, and tension increasing. They were on us 24/7 pretty much, and not in a good or bad way. It's just their way, because there are a lot more there are some rogue groups going around, and they wanted to protect us, but they also wanted to know exactly what we were doing when. Unemployment is up even more than it was in March. Fewer businesses, and women are bearing the burden of that because they're just trying to retain, you know, the family and infrastructure and integrity. And men are mostly unemployed, but women are getting jobs at the schools, which fortunately UNRWA, with John Ging, with the United Nations Works Relief Agency, has kept the schools going, which is a real blessing. Goods are less available, but they're extremely expensive. Israel determines what goes in when, and that's less and sporadic, so it could be you know, persimmons one day and wheat another day, but very little gets in, you know, less than, I think it's 15% of what's really needed. And then you have the tunnels, hundreds of tunnels, and it's a black market, and so it's extremely expensive. And, you know, with black markets, you get all the other groups, the rogue groups, again, you know, that are trying to power monger that on both sides, both Egyptian and Gaza side. The water out of the tap is salty. You know, the showers were cold, and the water is literally salty from the salt water coming into the wells. The desalinization plant had been destroyed, and so now the children are drinking this salt water, and they have severe kidney damage. The dialysis machines are not working because they can't get the parts in. Just things like that. The infrastructure was so destroyed during the last war in January that it's just compounded every day, every week, every month. So the garbage system was destroyed. So there's raw sewage around, and that's made more people sick. The World Health Organization determined that a hepatitis A outbreak was imminent. That, along with just having poor water, and that goes on into the farmers being unable to produce what they need to because their wells were also filled in and destroyed.
Kit Kittredge from Code Pink, let me ask you this. I understand that there's a not only an American but really worldwide and particularly European mobilization to break the siege and the Free Gaza movement that's going in there between Christmas and New Year's, and that you've been active in that. Can you give us an update on the organization of that demonstration?
It was very exciting to go to Gaza in September and work with the Palestinian people regarding the march, the Gaza Freedom March, that will be December 31st, and we will be marching from Beit Hanun over to the Israeli border. We will be marching in solidarity with the Palestinian people, and we met with great support from all the different groups that I met with, the non-governmental organizations that are there, children's centers, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hamas Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Education, students, medics, all the hospitals. We met nothing but support from the people, and they gave us great ideas, and we will be following the Palestinian people's lead in joining with many European nations that are also working with us. We had people from Italy, Malta, the UK, Australia, all working together and trying to get in, at least, well, we're hoping for 1,000 internationals to get in through the Rafah border in late December, just after Christmas, and we will be in Gaza at different places. We've got different areas set up either for camping or staying in hotels, and we will join together on the 31st and march in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And hopefully, the Minister of Foreign Affairs said, well, I can get you 50,000 Palestinian people easy to be marching with you. So we're very excited about that, and it's nice to have a really international surge to end the siege happening.
I think it's great. Before I get your reaction to some other issues, how, if people are interested in possibly going as a delegate, how do they do it?
Well, we have a great website, GazaFreedomMarch.org. About every question you need answered is on. It can be answered on that site, and I would recommend people going to there. They can see who is endorsing this march. They can see how they can participate and what it's all about.
I have a question about the Goldstone Report. We've discussed it on and off on our show quite a bit, and I'm interested in whether you had discussions with people about the Goldstone Report, the U.S. reaction, what their thinking is.
Well, Hamas supported the Goldstone Report, and U.S. and Israel did not support it. In fact, the U.S. pressured Fatah and the Palestinian Authority to not support it. That was very discouraging to the Palestinian people that I spoke with. My experience in Gaza is that they want nothing but diplomacy to happen, but they feel that international law needs to be upheld. And that was a very large hope that would report would be acknowledged and reviewed and seen on the international level. And so that they were very discouraged by that. And I am as well.
Yeah. Were you there when the PLO and Abbas said put it off for 6 months for the consideration by the Human Rights Council, and the Palestinians said we'll agree to put it off? Were you in Gaza then?
No, I was not.
What did you think about Abbas's position?
I find it unconscionable that a person of that integrity who put that report forward is not being acknowledged and looked at.
Kit Kittredge from Code Pink, you're organizing the Gaza Freedom March between Christmas and New Year's, GazaFreedomMarch.org. For all our listeners, please go to that website.
Thank you. I would like to put a plug in for the Gaza Freedom, the rally to support it in New York City that's coming up October 27th.
Let's go for it.
All righty. So it's 7 p.m. Tuesday at the Church of the Holy Trinity, 316 East 88th Street, New York, between 1st and 2nd Avenues. Great speakers, Jeff Halper, Joseph Massad, and our retired Colonel Ann Wright.
Kit, we really applaud you for your good work. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
All righty. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Decriminalization of drug possession has now gone into effect for 150 million Latin Americans. Mexico decriminalized the possession of a small amount of all drugs, and days later, the Argentine Supreme Court declared unconstitutional their own law that criminalized drug possession. What's happened in Mexico and now Argentina is very consistent with the broader trend in Europe and Latin America in terms of decriminalizing small amounts of drugs and promoting alternatives to incarceration and a public health approach for people struggling with drug addiction, said Ethan Nadelman, the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Nadelman also says that the global consensus on drug policy is changing as countries seek to counteract prison overcrowding, rise in organized crime, and drug violence. Ethan Nadelman joins us today. Ethan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Big developments south of the border in Mexico and Argentina. Mexico decriminalized possession of a small amount of drugs, and Argentina overthrew their own law on drug possession. Tell us about it and tell us what this means for the United States.
Well, you know, some of these things happening simultaneously is a matter of coincidence, and some is not. In Mexico, the Congress had proposed, even passed a law to decriminalize drug possession back in 2006, and former President Fox had supported it. And then when there was a sort of a hysterical reaction from us north of the border, especially from local prosecutors in San Diego and what have you, Fox backed away. But I think people understood all along that this was a good idea. It was a sensible reprioritization of police resources. So the idea came back again this year, and the Congress put it through, and President Calderon signed it. And everybody understood that this was in no way really related to the bigger war against the major violent drug traffickers, that it really had to do with deciding to prioritize police resources appropriately, to treat addiction primarily as a health issue, not a criminal issue, and also the recognition that many people who are getting arrested for drug possession don't really have a drug problem and shouldn't really be a concern of the state. So it's a very positive step in the right direction, and it goes pretty far, too. You know, it doesn't require that people be tossed into treatment program regardless of whether or not they have a drug problem. It's a pragmatic reform that will help in various ways.
So tell me, if I go to Mexico tomorrow, what's the law?
There's nothing in the law that's going to allow Mexico to set up coffee shops like you have in the Netherlands, or even the medical cannabis dispensaries like you have in California, now Colorado, and elsewhere. And then secondly, given the amount of tourism that's already driven by the fact that Mexico's got a lower drinking age, more liberal laws on prostitution, and cheaper and more available pharmaceutical drugs, I don't see any tourism happening. All it's going to mean, Michael, is that if you're able to buy some drugs in a small amount for your own use, and really a very small amount, and the stop you, they're not going to arrest you. You know, you'll basically be let go or maybe pay a small fine.
What are the drugs that are allowed?
This really applies to any drug. And it's very much consistent with the trend in elsewhere in Latin America and in Western Europe, and even, quite frankly, to some extent in the United States. I mean, it's this notion that people in possession of a small amount of drugs, clearly for their own use, should not be getting arrested and spending time in jail or prison. And that for those people who seem to have a drug addiction problem, they should be sent to a treatment program rather than to a jail cell. So it applies to any drug, but the amounts are very tiny, so that anybody caught, if you're even any kind of significant user and you're caught in possession of your own personal amount, you might still risk a jail penalty.
Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan, tell us a story in Argentina.
Well, that was a Supreme Court decision in Argentina, and they basically held that under the Constitution of Argentina that it would be unconstitutional to allow people to be punished for the simple possession or use of drugs just for themselves. And it was consistent with a Constitutional Court decision that happened in Germany back in 1995, and also with a decision in Colombia about 10 years or so ago. I mean, it is part of that sort of human rights, civil liberties tradition that exists in various ways and various languages in many parts of the world. I know the German Constitutional Court referred to it as the right to the development of your own personality. But the Argentine court really used very strong language in this regard. I'll tell you, look what's happening in Mexico, you look what's happening in Argentina, then you look in Brazil, where there was a similar reform back in 2006, and they seem poised to take a future step in the next year or so. Then you look in Ecuador, where the president, Correa, his father spent time behind bars on drug dealing charges. And so the Ecuadorian Congress passed a decriminalization law and I think also issued something of an amnesty for low-level drug dealers. So there really is a movement in Latin America that to some extent is following in the footsteps of what the Europeans have done, and in a couple of ways is maybe even leapfrogging them a bit.
Well, you think that the United States is too puritanical to go in the right direction like these other countries?
Well, you know, we're really very schizophrenic on this. That on the one hand, you see a real significant movement in a new direction. I mean, some of this has been happening for years. So we've known from our ballot initiatives and our polling that a substantial majority of Americans, and not just in New York or California, but even states like Florida or Missouri or Ohio, that two-thirds of Americans basically say that somebody who's picked up in possession of drugs and clearly has a problem of addiction should not be sent to jail the first couple of times they're arrested, that they should be offered treatment. So there is that general supposition. And over 70% of Americans also believe that possession of small amounts of marijuana should be decriminalized, that people should not be going to jail for that as well. So, and then if you see the shift in public opinion, I mean, support for actually not just decriminalizing marijuana, but for making it legal and taxing, controlling, and regulating it more or less like alcohol, I mean, support for that has jumped from, you know, 21 to 22% 20 years ago to over 40% nationally now, and 50% among Democrats and independents and people in the age of 30 and people in the western states. I mean, you got Governor Schwarzenegger saying we need a debate on legalizing drugs.
That's amazing.
So there's a lot of movement in a new direction. But on the other hand, we have this drug war, you know, prison industrial complex that keeps lumbering on with enormous sort of momentum and inertia behind it, you know, locking up 2.25 million people tonight, 500,000 people of those specifically on a drug law violation, $100 billion a year enterprise, and, you know, they're not giving up easy. So we really are a bit torn in the United States right now.
Ethan, I think in one way, you know, we've had you on before and I've followed your work for years. Everybody thought you were probably out of your mind 20 years ago, whenever you began, that you could ever legalize drugs anywhere. So one question is, how does it make you feel to at least see some of your work with such concrete achievements?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I mean, it is 20 years, and you're right. That was the way it was perceived back then. I would say it feels good, but I also know that this is a multi-generational effort and that I'm part of the first generation, or there was a small group of people before me, and that my job and obligation is to mentor and, you know, and hand off the baton eventually to the second and third generations. So I really look at this drug policy reform movement as basically an issue of, you know, as a movement for individual freedom and social justice. And I think that historically speaking, we stand poised in 2009 more or less where the gay rights movement was in the late 60s or the civil rights movement was in the late 40s or early 50s or the women's rights movement was at the turn of the last century or even the movement to abolish slavery and the slave trade was in the 1820s and 30s. You know, public opinion is moving our direction. You know, people understand it's about freedom and social justice. There are powerful vested interests on the other side. Other countries are moving forward more rapidly than we are. Our opponents play on people's fears about their women and the children. Simple economic arguments, cost-benefit arguments actually weigh in our favor. I mean, that's the similarity between the drug policy reform movement today and these past movements for freedom and social justice. And, you know, we are going to prevail, but it is a matter of time as well.
Just for opportunistic reasons, given the disaster that the American economy is in, they just might move to legalize it so they can tax it.
Quite frankly, when you look and ask the question, why was alcohol prohibition repealed so rapidly in the early 1930s? And there were dozens of reasons why people opposed alcohol prohibition. You know, the crime, the violence, corruption, the overflowing prison cells and courthouses, people disrespecting the law. I mean, all of this sort of stuff. But clearly the first, second, and third reasons were the Depression. And people coming to the conclusion that why should they be spending billions of dollars a year trying to enforce an unenforceable prohibition when instead they could be bringing in billions of dollars in revenue. So when we saw Governor Schwarzenegger standing up a few months ago and saying, you know, California could bring in $1.3 billion a year in tax revenue just from legalizing marijuana and meanwhile save hundreds of millions of dollars on enforcement costs, clearly it was the economy. And when you see Governor Patterson saying it's time for a discussion on this as well, clearly the economy is moving them as well. When you look at, you know, even conservative governors and state legislatures, not just, I mean, New York, but I'm talking about like Virginia, saying that we need to reduce the prison populations, that's being driven economically as well. When Schwarzenegger and the California State Legislature were forced last week to adopt a plan to reduce the prison population by tens of thousands of nonviolent offenders, it is certainly the number one factor, and I think if we do see marijuana get legalized in the next, you know, few years, or at least major momentum build up, the economy is going to be the number one thing driving it.
The issues in New York of the Rockefeller drug laws and the long periods people have spent in jail, 20, 30 years, for very minor amounts of drugs. Has there been any real reform of those laws? What can we look forward to? Is this on Patterson's agenda?
Well, I've been working on Rockefeller reform for 12 years, and there are others who have been working on it even longer. And back in 2004 and 5, we won a couple of minor victories, but they did result in thousands of people receiving lesser sentences and some people getting out earlier and in saving taxpayers almost $100 million. But this spring, things came together. You know, the Democrats took back the state Senate for the first time in 40 or 50 years, and everybody was looking for some good news to do. And in this horrible year in Albany, this became the thing that people got together on. So this spring, a major Rockefeller reform did in fact go through. The New York Times, page one, you know, lead column said Rockefeller drug laws repealed. Now, in fact, that went a little too far. They weren't actually repealed. But, in fact, there was a major shift. There was a reduction of sentences. The shift in power over sentencing from prosecutors to judges, which is something we've been fighting for a long time, some retroactivity, so people who were incarcerated in the old laws can apply for new sentencing and hopefully get out, and finally some significant commitment of funding for drug treatment for the people who need it. So that was a major reform, and it was sufficiently major that I think the rallying cry of repeal the Rockefeller drug laws is going to have less resonance from now on, and that the new rallying cry, I don't know what the rhetoric's going to be, but the reality is going to be really creating a fundamental paradigm shift in New York State from dealing with drugs as a criminal justice issue to dealing with it as a health issue.
We read a lot about the studies that have been done by various organizations, NYACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights, as well as the number of stop and frisks in New York and the number of drug busts. The number of stops is probably over 500,000. Yeah. High percentage of Black and Latinos, higher than their percentage in the population. And a lot of it's around ostensible enforcement of these drug laws by the Bloomberg administration. What have you seen? Has there been any efforts by the Bloomberg administration, or have they been willing to make any changes in this police enforcement?
It's an interesting thing. On drug policy, when you look on the health side, the Bloomberg administration and his former health commissioner, Tom Frieden, and now Frieden's successor, have been really good on the health stuff. I mean, on needle exchange, dealing with drug use as a health issue, preventing HIV, hep C, overdose fatalities, they really deserve some plaudits. But on the other hand, when it comes to the policing stuff, you know, this is an area where anything that Ray Kelly, the police chief, wants, Bloomberg just defers. So if Kelly, unlike, you know, his predecessor, Bill Braddon, says that the Rockefeller drug law reforms are no good, you know, Bloomberg just reiterates that stuff. And this crazy policy we've had in New York, where New York City is the marijuana arrest capital of the world. Right, it's averaging 40,000 marijuana arrests a year, notwithstanding the fact that New York passed a far-reaching marijuana decriminalization law back in 1977.
And that's arrests, you're saying, Ethan, right? That's arrests. That's not even stops, right?
That's arrests. I mean, there's, 800,000 stops. But if you look at the arrests and the petty arrests, marijuana arrests loom very large. It's mostly targeted at young Black and brown men, right? It's often who have not had a previous contact with the criminal justice system. There was an excellent report by Harry Levine and Deborah Small last year that the New York City Lawyers Union released, and there's a more recent update. There's a superb op-ed piece that my colleague Tony Newman wrote in the Daily News just last week on this issue. But 40,000 marijuana arrests a year, whereby what the cops do, because you can't arrest somebody for having less than an ounce in their pocket, they're basically stopping, and they're not seeing people smoking this in open. It's mostly the cops stopping young kids saying, you know, oh, can I look in your pockets? And the kid's nervous, and they say, yeah, take out what you got in your pockets. And then the marijuana becomes in public view. Now it's gone from an infraction to a misdemeanor. And the next thing to know, the kid is sitting in a police van and spending up to 48 hours in the New York jail system and landing up with a criminal record that may follow him for life. Kelly and others have said that these intensive marijuana arrests are part and parcel of their successful broken windows policing strategy. But quite frankly, they have provided no evidence to substantiate that claim. There are many other people in the system who says that this is a foolish waste of resources and that it's essentially easy stuff for the cops, easy arrests to make, easy overtime pay, you know, and not contributing to public safety in any way, even as it's really screwing with hundreds of thousands of people's lives.
Ethan, really, thank you very much for that. Your work has been extraordinary. And
give us the website for the Drug Policy Alliance so that our listeners can be in touch with you.
Sure. It's drugpolicy.org. And for anybody who's interested, once every 2 years, there is a biennial International Drug Policy Reform gathering. This is the leading gathering in the world of people opposed to the drug war. It's going to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico in mid-November. People should go to the website, drugpolicy.org, and I have to tell you, this event has been transformative for thousands of people over the years. But thank you very much for having me on. It was a great pleasure.
Ethan, thank you very much
nice
for your work.
Nice talk with you, Ethan. Ethan Nadelman, Drug Policy Alliance. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Since 9/11, the government has stepped up its surveillance of a range of individuals and organizations, including volunteer-based groups. After providing free vegetarian food in hundreds of communities worldwide, Food Not Bombs has found itself a part of the domestic terrorism dragnet. Co-founded by Keith McHenry and seven friends, the group is dedicated to nonviolent social change and recovers food that would otherwise be discarded to serve hot, free meals to the homeless, disaster survivors, rescue workers, and others. For a better understanding of how often and in what capacity Food Not Bombs has been surveilled and even harassed, we are joined by co-founder Keith McHenry. Keith has been arrested more than 100 times for making a political statement of sharing free food in San Francisco, and he has spent more than 500 nights in jail for peaceful protest. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Keith.
Well, thanks for having us.
Good to be with you, Keith.
Keith, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of Food Not Bombs that you and several others started back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and you've been through a lot over these almost three decades.
Yeah, we, in 1980 in Boston, you know, we were just college-age kids. I was a produce worker, and I was throwing out a lot of produce every morning, and it occurred to us that we could actually take some of that produce that we were throwing out from this organic grocery store to housing projects and battered women's shelters and so on to provide them with free food. But that we could also, make meals that we served on the streets at protests and in public as a way to do outreach to the community about, in those days, the war in El Salvador, the registration and the draft, the things of that nature, as well as, like, to promote the ideas of vegetarian eating, animal rights, the environment. We didn't really have a vision of it becoming global, but today we share free vegan and vegetarian meals in 1,000 cities every week.
1,000 cities? What? Wait a second. 1,000 cities?
Yeah, 1,000 cities of the world. Say, Moscow, Russia, we have 8 chapters in Moscow in 8 different neighborhoods.
So when you say 1,000 cities, you have even more groups than 1,000 then? Because
correct. We have more groups than 1,000 cities. We are in Iceland and Reykjavik. We have Warsaw, Poland has 12 chapters.
Let me ask you, how much food do you think you deliver a day?
It's in the tons per, if you add it up around the world, I suspect. I mean, it is just huge. Some of the places, like New Orleans, has hundreds of people show up every day to eat. Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, same thing. So it's very hard to estimate.
So you must but if you have 1,000 and let's say even only 10 people show up, it's 10,000 people a day, but it might be 100, it might be 50,000, it might be huge.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I've never really done that. I kind of added stuff up maybe about 20 years ago to have some idea, but now the events have taken over. And every week I get yesterday I worked with two different young people that were starting Food Not Bombs chapters. One in Framingham, Massachusetts, another in the southern end of New Zealand. It's amazing. And every week I get maybe 6 to 10, sometimes even 20 requests for additions to the Food Not Bombs website.
Well, tell us, this is an extraordinary work of human kindness that you're in the middle of. And now the government is taking notice of you and trying to stop what essentially good people from the New Testament on trying to do. Tell me, what happened to you as a consequence of your efforts to distribute food?
Well, in 1988, I ended up getting arrested on August 15th at Golden Gate Park for serving food without a permit.
Whoa.
And 9 of us were arrested that day. We had actually made the mistake, we discovered, writing a letter to the Recreation and Parks Department requesting a permit. And this was at the insistence of another man who was, he made the suggestion because he was running a soup kitchen in the same neighborhood and he didn't serve on Mondays and that was the day we chose to serve. And it turned out in hindsight the police had gone to him, threatened to shut down his soup kitchen because of our serving every Monday under the banner Food Not Bombs. And when they arrested us, we ultimately were arrested over 1,000 times in San Francisco I ended up facing 25 years to life in prison under the California three strikes law. And he didn't mind that we were feeding people. It was that we were making a political statement, and that's not allowed.
What's the political statement you were making?
Well, that the money and resources could go more towards feeding the hungry, providing health care, education, and other things that would really make us even more secure, and diverting some of the money from the military towards domestic human needs.
Now, can you bring us up to date a little bit? Has anything happened recently on this kind of issue?
Well, yes. We're having, in fact, and as of March, we started having this unique trend that we haven't seen in our 30 years around the issue of serving food. And what happened is anonymous people would go to the state governments and or to city officials in different communities and file complaints against us. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, we were started to be fined $500 a day, every day we served, because of this anonymous complaint, which we found out was from from military personnel who had objected to our statement. And we have a similar thing in Flagstaff, Arizona. They said you could serve the food, you just can't have literature and a banner and publicize your political position. We had a similar thing last week in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where the health department showed up based on anonymous tip. Now, the last time in Lancaster, about 12 months ago, the anonymous tipster turned out to be a man that manufactured landmines about a quarter of a mile away from where we were sharing free meals, and he happened to walk by it and was offended by the banner saying food, not bombs. Health department official in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, showed up without a thermometer, without any way to, you know, test the pH of food, and actually told us it was fine that we're feeding people, we just had to get rid of the literature. And this is what we are seeing, anonymous tipster in Northampton, Massachusetts, same thing. And so we've been having this problem on a larger basis, including statewide, where I received letters from the state of New Mexico ordering me to tell all chapters in the state to stop serving free food. When we go and try to negotiate with the states, it doesn't, you know, we get like a health inspected kitchen and all this stuff, and they just ignore it. The other issue place is Connecticut. I started receiving emails ordering me to tell all chapters in Connecticut to stop. Middletown was a Connecticut chapter, was arrested and prosecuted. The health inspector said it was an anonymous tip. We believe that we're going to find out that tipster was another defense contractor, as is the case in other cities.
About that. Right. Obviously, it's systemic what's going on, that there's some kind of group, whether it's defense contractors and others, going after you. Do you have any evidence yet of that happening, other than the fact that it's that every time you seem to trace it down, it seems to go to somebody? Do you think the federal government's involved?
Well, I do think the federal government is involved. We've seen a lot of evidence that the FBI, Homeland Security, actually private security agencies, including like the intelligence unit of Chevron Oil, have been involved in monitoring and harassing Food Not Bombs. We were first initially declared, from what we could tell, a terrorist organization in 1988, you know, when terrorism wasn't really all that fashionable. After getting arrested, some of our volunteers would run into military personnel at airports, or in the first case, it was one of our volunteers went to visit a friend at her home on Thanksgiving in 1988. Her friend's husband had returned from 3 days of National Guard training where they had been studying domestic terrorism. When the husband saw her wearing a Food Not Bombs button on her coat, said, well, that's the group we've been studying all weekend as one of America's most hardcore terrorist groups. And then we started getting more evidence. In one case where I was arrested on October 15th, 1988, we discovered that we had my home phone had been wiretapped, and a memo that was written on September 27th of 88 discussed a phone conversation between me and one of my friends about just how we were now going to be serving food in three cities at a protest against the war in El Salvador all on the same day, and we had never done this before. and they turned it into us taking over an army base, and they refer in the memo to other intelligence agencies that they need to report this information to, and then on the date that they refer to, I get arrested. A person that turned out to be a San Francisco police officer wearing the same clothes as me threw police barricades at a line of riot police, and then I got actually pretty badly roughed up and arrested for the crime of throwing the barricades at the riot police.
Keith, was your personal life also affected by infiltration?
Absolutely. I have been under huge stress for many years on and off from what has turned out to be informants trying to have me forced out of Food Not Bombs. I've lost a couple of friends who have committed suicide as a result of the tension created by informants in San Francisco Food Not Bombs in particular. And then when I was facing the three strikes case, I was in North County, Alameda in Oakland, California, when a man who turned out to be an FBI agent started to hang out with my wife at the California Street bus stop outside of her work. And he became friends with my wife and ended up having an affair with her during the time I was incarcerated, and we had no idea whether I would end up getting out of prison or not. And this was extremely disrupted to our marriage, and in fact ended the marriage when she came forward and had noted that she'd had this affair with this law enforcement officer while I was in jail.
Did your former wife tell you that he had asked for information about Food Not Bombs?
It appeared to me that from what she was saying was a matter of just breaking up the relationship. My sense was, and I think even my wife's sense for many years during that time, was that everything we were saying in our house was being monitored. One case, my home phone had become a payphone, and I was very frustrated that I could not dial out for about 6 weeks. I eventually went to the local police chief, Fred Lau, who was a new, more liberal chief of police that had just been hired, and asked for some help on how to get my phone to no longer be a payphone.
Keith, and, yeah. What do you mean your home phone was a payphone?
Well, when I would pick up my home phone, which by that time I'd had for 10 years, it was the Food Not Bombs, you know, hotline, the toll-free number 1-800-884-1136 rang at this phone. But when I tried to dial out, it said, please deposit 35 cents. And so I would call 611 Pacific Bell Phone Repair from that phone, and they would tell me it was a payphone. And I said, well, I am actually paying a bill every month now for over a decade. After 6 weeks of trying to get the phone company to fix this, they kept claiming it really was a payphone. I ended up talking to the chief, who sent over a man in a white van with the ladders on top. It was just California plates. He went to a pole on the outside of my house, and my roommate and I just stood there watching this thing in amazement. A garage door opened across the street. This is on Spruce Street in San Francisco near Geary. There were two men inside this garage with a folding table and laptops and headphones, and they made little motions to the man on the ladder at the telephone pole. And then after about 20 minutes, the man came down, put the ladder on his truck, and drove away. And the garage doors went down, and leaving the two guys behind it. And I went in, and my phone finally worked.
Keith McHenry from Food Not Bombs. What? This would be farcical if it wasn't so serious. You're only trying to do a decent, humane act for people. They've got you covered front and back by a huge surveillance outfit. It's really quite extraordinary. Let me bring it up to date, Keith. Tell us what's happening to your organization now and what our listeners can do to show some support.
Well, there's two broad things that are happening right now that are of concern. One, we are being ordered to stop serving food in communities all over the United States. So we really need support in that by people going to our website, foodnotbombs.net, writing letters to the different political leaders in these communities. That's one issue. Now, the other issue that's very disturbing that we've been working on quite a bit in the last decade, really, is the fact that we discovered that we were considered by the FBI and Homeland Security to be one of the top terrorist groups in the United States. And as a result, we've had a huge number of cases of informants joining Food Not Bombs. One of the more famous ones most recently was the Republican National Convention, where we had five informants join Food Not Bombs at different times in Minneapolis. The first one was a woman about my age that turned out to be a narcotics officer for Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, who brought her niece, who turned out not to be a niece, but another informant, to our meetings, and they advocated the firebombing of Republicans and so on at the convention. That became warrants resulting in the raids of three of our cookhouses in St. Paul and the charging of eight people in what's called the RNC 8 case. So if you go to rnc8.org, you can read up on it. A mysterious aspect of that case, however, is that the links between the fact that these were Food Not Bombs volunteers organizing meals to provide food to the protesters at the Republican convention seems to be getting lost in the entire debate. But that's actually what was happening. And initially, we were targeted for being Food Not Bombs. So we have a number of people, roughly 20 to 25 volunteers that are doing prison time right now for cases where the FBI would organize a crime. They would do the crime or they would suggest the crime, and then our volunteers would be arrested and charged with plotting to do whatever the crime was and receive, in some cases, like Eric McDavid, who is a West Philadelphia Food Not Bombs volunteer, who helped me organize a gathering there in 2005. His girlfriend turned out to be an FBI informant, and she tried to convince him to bomb a dam on the Sacramento River. He refused. He was Food Not Bombs. He thought that was crazy. And when the FBI, the Sacramento field office, realized he wasn't going to do it, they raided the house, claiming he might threaten this informant's life, arrested three of our volunteers, and then pitted them against one another. And Eric is now doing 19 years and 8 months in prison for plotting to bomb a dam that he was arguing against doing. This woman, who he then discovered was not really his girlfriend, but a FBI informant of quite a number of years.
Keith, everything you have just described to us is classic COINTELPRO practice. I think your case, Food Not Bombs, an organization dedicated to nonviolence, has been targeted, vilified, infiltrated, and disrupted in all of the textbook examples of how COINTELPRO operated, and we're seeing it again now. We hope to have you on again, and we hope to hear that some of these tactics diminish in the near future.
Thank you so much. The biggest issue that we have been spreading amongst the Food Not Bombs community is that somebody is joking about violence or suggesting it at a meeting, that you have to distance yourself from that person. You don't need to call them out and say, well, you are an infiltrator, but we are trying to really educate people that if people are joking about even throwing rocks at cops and things like that, that you have to make a very public stand that, no, we don't do that. And we passed a nonviolence code and have it on our website, written collectively by a group of about 30 Food Not Bombs volunteers in San Francisco back in the early 90s, which is still the agreement that we have amongst all our chapters. And these problems are only happening in the United States. We're in over 500 cities outside the U.S. We have virtually no such problems outside the borders of the United States. It seems to be totally focused on this country.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs. It's foodnotbombs.net. We urge our listeners to go to it. Give them all the support you can. It's been very good having you on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Keith.
Talk to you later, Keith.
Thank you, Heidi. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.